Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in Canada's beautiful maritime provinces, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland, 9 p.m. in the British Isles, 10 p.m. Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Jerusalem and Moscow, and the early hours of Saturday morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners. But wherever you are, welcome along to another of our Clubland Q&As, in which I answer questions from Mark Stein Club members live around the planet. Before we get going, I want to mention a couple of things just very quickly. This one is mainly for our Antipodean listeners, but at on Tuesday morning Australian time, I will be participating in a special event on Zoom. I mean, Zoom isn't really special events, but let's face it, it's going to be as special as it gets after 7 months of bloody lockdown. There's nothing live, there's nothing on stage, there's nothing on the big screen. Zoom's as good. It's Zoom now and forever, so get used to it. But it won't be one of those annoying Zoom things with 37 different faces on the screen. It'll just be me and the great John Roscombe. And your questions, as we talk about liberty in a land that could use a lot more of it. That's Australia. The Institute of Public Affairs, IPA, don't confuse it with India Pale Ale, although if you have the misfortune to live in the state of Victoria, drinking India Pale Ale 18 hours a day is about the best practical solution to what's going on there. But this is the other Victorian IPA. The Institute of Public Affairs, John Roscombe and I will be live. And it's between 9 and noon, according to which bit of Australia you're in. But it'll be 9 p.m. North American Eastern Time, which is 1 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. It's basically 9 a.m. Western Australia. If you're in the Northern Territory, it kicks off at 10:30, 11 a.m. Queensland, 11:30 a.m. South Australia, and then midday if you're in Victoria, New South Wales and Tasmania. I'll put a link up at Stein Online later, but we would love to have you join us. You have to be a member of the IPA, and if you're under 25, it's a bargain, because I think it's just 10 bucks, and it goes up on a sliding scale from there. So if you're 108, it's screwed. It's probably beyond the capacities of your wallet to bear. But if you're under 25, it's 10 bucks. So we would certainly appreciate you coming along for the ride. It's not just for our many Australian listeners, but it's also of interest to anybody, not just in the British Commonwealth or in the English-speaking world, but also anywhere around the world. We'll be talking freedom, which is always fun, with the great John Roscombe. The other point I wanted to raise before we begin is a slightly sadder one, a much sadder one, actually. Our dear friend Kathy Shadle, who's peerless movie column is one of the great glories every weekend at Stein Online, has had a recurrence of her cancer. So Kathy is seriously under the weather at the moment. She's had a very rough week, and all the COVID procedures actually make it even more difficult, because you can't even be visited by people in the way one normally could in these circumstances. So please keep Kathy in your hearts. Hold her fast in your hearts and in your prayers. I have loved reading her ever since this miserable, rotten century began. In a sane world, she would be Canada's equivalent of Julie Burchill. We have certainly done our best to ensure that she gets some of the credit she deserves. But she's had a pretty big stinker of a week, which I understand is like getting a little more stabilized. But do please keep Kathy in your prayers. And with that, we will get to our various questions from Mark Stein Club members around the planet. Douglas Neviera, I hope I pronounced that correctly. It's a bit like the Riviera, but it's the Neviera. And Douglas says, Mark, I am getting worried about President Trump's re-election due to the downward trend in the polls. I recognize that the polls may very well be wrong. However, Trump's recent drop must mean something. No. Your thoughts on where the race stands? Thank you, Douglas. Yes, I saw a piece today. I think it was by Neil Patel, who's our pal Tucker's business partner, basically. They founded the Daily Caller together. And he's sort of preparing the ground for a catastrophic defeat. He says the election may be over. That's over at the Daily Caller. He says he acknowledges that Mike Pence had a good debate, but that's not going to fundamentally change the race. And he acknowledges, too, that polling has become a bit more haphazard in recent years, and that there is certainly such a thing as a shy vote. Basically, if you can be threatened with, well, not just threatened, but if you can actually lose your job for supporting Trump, then people do become more circumspect. And actually, if you're portrayed as a hater, racist, white supremacist, how eager are you going to be to say you're a Trump supporter to some stranger on the telephone who's just calling up on behalf of Gallup or Rasmussen? In fact, you don't even know whether they're from Gallup or Rasmussen. Might just be the local branch office of Antifa or Black Lives Matter. And if they find out you're a Trump supporter, they'll be standing outside your house 45 minutes later. I think that I heard that just on the local news. I think it's actually in Vermont. Somewhere in Vermont, somebody didn't vote the way they wanted at the council meeting, and the Black Lives Matter guys, the Antifa mob, are all standing outside the house. And the local station just reported it as if it's a normal phenomenon. No, it's not. Not when they come to your house. That's a way of saying, we know where you live, we know where you sleep, and you're going to sleep more uneasily knowing that we know where you live. And there is an element of that. Whether there's a 16-point element of that, according to the CNN poll, I don't know. I will say this. I'm disturbed by the way not just Trump has slid, because you have to take the view, you know, yeah, there's a shy Trump vote. How big is that? Last time round, it was worth 3.5-4 points. I would imagine it's got bigger than that. So it might actually be worth, a conservative would estimate it's worth 5 or 6 points maybe. And if you're truly invested in the theory of the shy Trump vote, you might think it's up 7 or 8 points. It gets very difficult to believe in a shy Trump vote that is worth 14 points, according to the NBC poll, or 16 points, according to the CNN poll. And there is a 10-point average now for the Biden lead in the Real Clear Politics poll of polls, which, if it comes true, is a Biden landslide and a lost Senate. And that's what Neil Patel, Tucker's business partner, is writing about. He's writing about what's going to happen if these polls are correct and what can we do to mitigate it. Honestly, I think what you can do to mitigate it is get on the first plane out of here. It's going to be very difficult if Biden and Kamala and the Democrats hold the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And what is actually distressing to me is the slippage. Last time round, you know, there were Republicans who were prevailed upon to distance themselves from Trump because of the Access Hollywood tape and all the other stuff. And the ones who did distance themselves all underperformed Trump. They distanced themselves right out of electoral politics, like my own Senator Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, who distanced herself and lost to Maggie Hassan, the Democrat. And right now, they're sliding. The Senate is sliding as fast as the White House polls are. So, for example, that awful, useless twit in Arizona, Martha McSally, is now 7 or 8 points behind the guy, Mark Kelly, the Democrat. And the question then becomes, OK, I can believe in a shy Trump vote. The idea of a shy Martha McSally vote opening up an 8-point lead, and don't worry about it because there's an 8-point shy Martha McSally vote, that becomes a little harder to believe in. I think realistically, either two things will happen. Either these polls are right and it's Nixon over McGovern. It's a 49-state blowout. And it's going to be a Biden blowout, just like Nixon in 72. But there isn't going to be any Watergate because it would be a Democrat Watergate. And that never goes anywhere. Just like Bill Barr said today, the Durham report isn't going to be out now till after the election. So all those nincompoops, well, just never mind the first report. That was very narrowly focused. You wait, the Durham report's going to nail these people. If the Durham report, if Biden wins, there isn't going to be a Durham report. You can forget about that. So I don't think there's any doubt that there's been slippage since that first debate. And the question then is, can the president turn it around? And yes, certainly he can turn it around. I mean, we get over-invested in these electoral snapshots from July, August, September, whatever. Don't forget that we're 3.5 weeks away from Election Day. And in every other country, that would be more than half the campaign. You know, in the United Kingdom, you have a 6-week campaign. In Australia, you have a 6-week campaign. Canada, you have a 6-week campaign. So there would still be more than half the campaign to go. And that means that it can still be won or lost by anybody. But there are disturbing aspects to... Oh, I said I should actually complete this thought because I said either it'll be like the blowout that the polls are saying and people will say, hooray, the polls are back on. They finally figured out how to operate in the age of mobile telephones and the internet and they're now tracking people accurately and they were right this time and it's Joe Biden's 16-point blowout and it's 49 states to Biden and just Wyoming to Trump. That may happen. Or the alternative to that theory is that this is a base election. I'm on the record already as saying turnout is going to be lower than 2016, which means we're not going to see Obama-type turnout as we did in 2008 because Biden isn't Obama. There's no enthusiasm for him. The base is depressed. And it's probably further depressed after that debate. I mean, the idea that there's going to be a huge turnout, people who tuned into that debate were sick of it. If you're non-political, they were sick of it after 10, 15, 20 minutes. What's that going to do? Is it going to drive you to the polls? Secondly, we don't know what the polling turnout is going to be like with the COVID, with all this mail-in voting and all the rest of it. Although that tends to support the Democrats in that after November the 3rd, the mail-in ballots get counted, and that's where the Democrats are going to steal the election. But setting that aside, I would say it's likely to be a low turnout election, which means it's a base election, which means it's a question of which group of hardcore supporters are more enthused. And on balance, that's Trump's best chance to win. I'll add a further thought. I'm a little depressed that most people, they don't follow the political shows. Oh, and just, I'm getting a bit rambly here. I've done too much radio and TV this week. So all my pithy thoughts have been expressed and I'm just rambling around here. But I'll say one other thing on that too. Most people don't watch the political shows or listen to the political shows because the privilege of living in a free society is that elections shouldn't normally precipitate you from liberty to tyranny over one Tuesday night in November. So most people aren't terribly political and they just pick up a little bit of the campaign from the ads that run during Ellen or Jeopardy or whatever. And one of the interesting features about that is I don't see any Trump ads, because the Trump campaign under Brad Parscale, who's now said to have filched about $40 million, he's currently institutionalized because he's had some kind of mental breakdown, allegedly, although there's a lot of us who think that's spin, and he was just in fact engaging in spousal abuse and is now institutionalized for whatever reason. And he's said to have blown through $40 million. The campaign doesn't have any ads. You never see any Trump ads. The only one I ever see is that one with policemen saying that they support Trump. Otherwise, I see tons of Biden ads, no Trump ads, because the campaign's out of money. And that's a terrible thing that's happened. So, you know, it's one thing to have to counter the polls and the bias in the polls. It's one thing to have to counter the debates and the bias in the debates. Trump now has to counter the fact that Biden is flush with cash and he's running all these ads, and Trump is pulling his ads from states because the campaign's run out of money. None of this is good news. There's no alternative. There's you. If you want to make this a fair election, you've got to make sure you get to the polls, and you've got to find someone you know who might be a voter, might not be a voter, and you've got to make sure they get to the polls too. That's all there is. But it isn't good, and no one thought after these 4 years that this is where Trump would be going into this election. Scott Scherzer said, dear Mark, recently I have had for the first time the sinking feeling that President Trump will not win re-election. In my opinion, he blew a prime opportunity to highlight the vast policy and philosophical differences between him and Joe Biden in the first debate. His performance seems strictly to appeal to his already committed base, with zero interest in bringing any new supporters into the fold. I believe that it is still possible for him to reach out to those suburban women that can't stand his personality, but fear that the Democrat Party has gone too far to the left. Do you think it is possible for him to rein in his ego for the next 3 weeks and perform more like VP Pence did in Wednesday night's debate? What do you think of his chances of being re-elected? From Scott Scherzer in Miami Beach, FLA. And Scott, to get to the base, do you think it's possible for him to rein in his ego? It's not possible for Donald Trump to be someone other than Donald Trump for the next 3.5 weeks. When you talk about Mike Pence's debate performance, I did Rush's show yesterday, and I woke up as expecting to have to analyze the tremendous victory of Mike Pence over Kamala Harris. And instead, I woke up to find that the so-called Presidential Debate Commission had stepped on, you know, which is, again, just the usual American racket, the bipartisan racket. It's just garbage. There shouldn't be a Presidential Debate Commission. But this lousy, garbage Presidential Debate Commission waited 20 minutes after the vice presidential debate ended, and everyone was going on about Pence's fantastic performance, fantastic victory. Kamala was smug and sneering and unlikable and all the rest of it. And he had her on the ropes and all the rest of it. And they then took it upon themselves to announce unilaterally that the next debate would be a virtual debate. Trump was on Maria Bartiromo's show as this was announced. And he, too, immediately stepped all over Pence's great performance by saying he wasn't going to participate in any virtual debate. And immediately, so the debate was off and he was out of here and he was done. And so he stepped all over Mike Pence's performance. And you can't do anything about that. That's just the way he is. But as I've said, really, not just this cycle, but before, there are two things here. There are two bases. There's a Trump base. There's a Trump base that loves Trump, just adores him and extends that adoration to his family, extends that adoration to all his jokes. So they love the Tulsa rally where he's riffing on how difficult it is walking down a ramp in leather-soled shoes. at the Naval Academy or whatever it, wherever it was, and he's just doing, and they love that. It's hilarious, and it is. It's great stand-up. But then there's other, there's another base which loves Trumpism, and the two bases need each other. You know, Trump won because he was talking about things that people actually cared about, as opposed to the Democrats who are talking about transgender bathrooms and the Republicans who are talking about boots on the ground in countries nobody's ever heard of, or bleep hole countries, as Trump would say. And so what got Trump elected was that he was talking about real things, border enforcement. No more stupid, pointless 20-year wars, unwon, return of manufacturing, China, real things that impact your life. That's the Trumpism. Trump needed Trumpism, and at the same, by the same token, Trumpism needs Trump, because it was only a personality of that size who had the way to overcome the media bias and actually smash through and get a hearing on issues like immigration and an end to the endless wars. And there's been a certain Trumpism deficit, I would say, so far. Trump didn't really bring up a lot of Trumpism in that debate last week. Mike Pence was rather more effective at it. But the way to turn this thing around, even if it's a base election, is for Trump to put Trumpism front and center, and to put the issues that he won, that the issues that me, and again we can go back through the history, and if it all goes over the cliff on November the 3rd, people will be doing about that, and they'll look back to 2017 and 2018 when he had that chump Paul Ryan basically sabotaging the Trump agenda, actively sabotaging it in the House of Representatives, when he had various persons around him sabotaging it in the White House, and a lot of the stuff that made the difference in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, states where he won very narrowly and which in the most recent polls show Biden 20 points ahead in a couple of them. 20 points ahead among seniors. I should qualify that. 20 points ahead among seniors who made the difference, in his narrow victory there. And we now have, and he needs to get I'd like a little, you know, I want the guy to win, and I would like the guy to win big, and I think that's slipping a little out of reach. But even if it's a narrow victory, I want Trump to talk more about Trumpism in the 3.5 weeks. P.K. Weasel, I hope that's how you pronounce it. It might be Weasel, it might be Weisel, but the P.K. I can pronounce. So P.K. says, with voter fraud, hacking of computers, and the sheer number of voters, is there any way we could have an honest, fair election? Cheaters are always going to cheat. The sheer number shouldn't mean anything, because we're only going to have a, last time around I think we had a 56% turnout. It'll be lower than that this time. So basically half the people don't, can you imagine if it was like Australia and you had compulsory voting? So basically everybody, you don't have turnout models because everybody shows up. And you could imagine what it would be like at these Democrat precincts. We wouldn't know the result of the last election until a week and a half before the next election, because it's so incompetent. It ought to embarrass Americans. As I've said a couple of times in the last few weeks, the province of New Brunswick managed to hold an election. Polls closed at 8 p.m. Atlantic time, and they announced the result at 8:55 p.m. There is no reason for COVID to affect the election. This thing, that the COVID has become an election factor only to provide this, the cover for the Democrats to cheat. I'm not worried about hacking of computers. It doesn't even get to that sophisticated, PK. We've seen things with mailmen just dumping out ballot forms. We've seen That was in New Jersey. It was in some other state. I think it was it Pennsylvania, where they threw away all the ballots. The cheating has already begun. This is a conscious choice of Americans. Have the crappiest elections, the most dysfunctional elections, the most embarrassingly awful elections in the, I won't even say the Western world, because there's actually countries in Africa that you think of as just bleephole countries, as the president would say, and they actually managed to hold better elections than this. This is a choice. There's two reasons for the COVID. Keeping it going. One, so that it provides an excuse for Joe Biden just to stay home. Because if Joe Biden was what he was doing, you remember Joe Biden up till the New Hampshire primary. So Joe Biden, from the moment he announced through Iowa and New Hampshire, he was just wandering on stage. You put him on stage, he'd like meander around, looking at the floor, talking in a hushed voice. When someone asked him a question, even if it was a friendly question, he'd threaten to punch their lights out. Even if it was like a heavy-set guy who was asking him about Hunter Biden's corruption, or if it was a cute little co-ed from an American college asking him why he'd done so badly in Iowa, and he'd call her a lying dog-faced pony soldier, and he'd want her to step outside so he could punch her lights out. Joe Biden was nuts. He was floundering. He was nuts. So the COVID has two purposes. It is intended until November the 3rd to provide a rationale for the non-campaign, because Joe Biden is only 16 points ahead on CNN because no one's seen him for months. And whereas we've seen a lot of Trump, and it might actually be better to, as we'll know on November the 3rd, it might actually be better, as I suggested a few days ago, if Trump had actually sort of gone a bit quiet when he checked into Walter Reed. And we'd heard a bit more from surrogates like Mike Pence. Because if you're interested in how to appeal to suburban women, chances are, you know, you can do a little bit better with Mike Pence. But if he does pull this off, it'll be because he's totally... Trump upturned the whole, all the conventions of American electioneering on their head last time round. Biden has done something even better. He said you don't need a different kind of campaign. You can win with no campaign. You can win just by staying at home because of a public health emergency. And that will take you over the finish line. Sharon Silver says, G'day, Mark. Today, Trump posted, Crazy Nancy Pelosi is looking at the 25th Amendment in order to replace Joe Biden with Kamala Harris. The Dems want that to happen fast because Sleepy Joe is out of it. He's correct. It's a setup on the chance they win. I believe with all my heart he will win, but dread what else they will try once Election Day is over. What is your prediction on how things will transpire? I agree with you on that. I don't think under any circumstances, and I accept, you know, in my lifetime we got used to the replacement of the head guy in Moscow with some waxwork who'd been dead for the previous 6 months, and they just lean him up on the podium to preside over the May Day parade. And all those guys who came over. Well, Brezhnev, I think, was dead for the last 5 years of his term. And then we had Andropov, who dropped off about 6 months before he became the leader. And then we had Chernenko. And as I said, all these dead guys, basically, propped up on the podium. And now the Democrats, when people say... I tend to feel that, you know, the Democrats are just communists. All that kind of thing is a bit overheated. But they're absolutely right in that they're now doing the communist thing of installing the dead guy as leader. And the dead guy, I don't think they can keep Biden propped up for 4 years because he's going to be saying weird things. Even if everybody's running the show, you have to wheel the guy out to deliver the State of the Union. He's going to say he'll be fine for 10 minutes and then something will happen and he'll say something totally freaky. He has to at least greet the leaders incoming for the G7 or whatever. And so they'll drive my old friend Boris or Justin or Angela Merkel or Monsieur Macron, whoever it is, up to the porte cochere at the White House. And they'll come and sit in the wing chairs by the fireplace with Biden, and Biden will say something bonkers. Even as a ceremonial figurehead, he won't be able to hold on for 4 years. I mean, what would be best from the Democrats' point of view is if he held out for 2 years and at 2 years and 1 day into his term, he stepped down, was replaced by Kamala. She could then serve another 2 full terms and she'd be president till 2033. That would work out very nicely for them. But I don't think they'll keep him going for 2 years. I don't see how they can. He's declined since the New Hampshire primary. What's going to be left there in 18 months' time, I dread to think. But I don't think Trump is quite right. They're bringing all this 25th Amendment stuff in because they're actually thinking of installing Kamala. Andrew Vaccaro writes from Down Under, says, Mark, thank you for continuing to remind listeners around the world of what's happening here in Melbourne and throughout Victoria. In my 40 years, I never thought I would see what is happening to my great city. Curfews now dropped. They were sort of gradually ameliorated. 5-kilometre travel limits. That means you can basically go within 3 miles of your home. Mandated masks. 2 hours of exercise permitted a day. Be grateful, Andrew. Your local dictator basically doubled the amount of time you're allowed to leave the house for, because it was only an hour till a couple of days ago. Police with powers to issue fines and detain people at will. Continued state of emergency. Half our shopping centres closed. Churches closed, etc. At the centre of all this is our Premier Daniel Andrews, who is not only the worst leader in Australia's history, is now on par to achieving the status as one of Australia's worst human beings. With this continual, cruel and unnecessary extension of these lockdowns, which are now 3 months in from an original 6 weeks. Andrews is an unabashed socialist, totally at the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. He was actually about to sign Victoria over to China's Belt and Road Initiative before the federal government stepped in. What is worse is that at the moment he is facing increased scrutiny over mishandling of our hotel quarantine program, where he utilized untrained security guards to maintain isolation of infected people rather than the army, which drove the major second wave that Melbourne saw, leading to the death of over 800 people, mainly in aged care, much like what happened in New York. I've never despaired as much as I am now. That's right. This actually, just on that specific point, Andrew, this business, people say, well, you know, when bad things happen, people trust in government more. That when something novel and unknown hits, you look to your government more than you might in times of normality. Well, if you do, more fool you. Basically, the people who were most entrusted to the care of the relevant authorities were the people in the care of those supposedly heavily regulated old folks' homes. I forget what they're called. You can't say old folks' homes anymore, but whatever the stupid euphemism for it is, were the ones who were most vulnerable and the ones we should thus have protected the most. Instead, we killed them all because we said, oh, you haven't got any COVID in your old folks' home, so let's put some people in there with you. And you have situations like in the United Kingdom. 40% of the deaths in the UK are people who died in those old folks' homes. In normal circumstances, that would be enough to end my dear friend Boris's term as Prime Minister, because he bungled the whole bloody thing. If COVID is this stupid thing where we're regulating the lives of perfectly healthy 22-year-olds to protect octogenarians and nonagenarians. But it doesn't make any difference because people like Andrew Cuomo kill off all the octogenarians and nonagenarians anyway. Andrew says, what I wanted to ask you, Mark, is why do you think so many people within a society accept this taking of our freedoms and do not see how bad a leader someone like Daniel Andrews is? Unbelievably, even with his descent into dictatorship, his and his government's complete incompetence, his selling out to China, he still probably has the support of close to half the Victorian public. Though recently I've seen more and more people in my day-to-day life fed up with him. Why do you think it had to get this bad for all these people to see what we saw from the start? And why do you think they are so deferential to government in spite of all the incompetence and tyranny? I think this is a great question, actually, because what would be dangerous? You can have a lot of bad indicators about a society. You can have high inflation, or you can have poor education results. But there's something more fundamental. It's a little bit in After America about this. When a people lose the habits of liberty, when they lose the habits of liberty, that is thinking as a free person, that is thinking on the basic common law proposition that unless something is expressly forbidden, it's permitted. In other words, that the onus is on the government to justify that small number of things it forbids. Once you forget that, and once you get into the habit of the situation in Victoria and many other parts of the world now, where basically whether you can leave the house, whether you can go and have a meal inside in a restaurant, whether you can go and open your business, is now in the gift of the state, on and on and on. That does get very close to a people that have lost the habits of liberty, and there are not a lot of easy ways back from that. John Fry writes, pardon the sarcasm, but how to explain the Tucker Carlson Tonight ratings phenomenon with the Harris-Biden ticket 16 points up. Maybe it's due in part to our host's more regular appearances. Any guest hosting opportunities in sight for TCT? Tucker doesn't need any guest host. As you know, when the lockdown started in March, I gave up television. I think I forget what it was for, 2-3 months, because it was all very difficult. My makeup with the makeup lady—that's a very intimate relationship that at a time of COVID spread and all the rest of it—is those things became difficult. Basically, it's been the death of TV. This, because as I've said, I'm old school on TV. I like to do Fox and Friends on the days when it has a live audience. I like to walk out on stage, clasp hands with all the adoring members of the audience, hug them, all the rest of it. And then I like to go over, shake hands with Brian and Steve and give a big kissy, kissy, kissy to Ainsley, because that's what being on TV is all about. If you're not kissing the lady, you're not really on TV. And so this YouTubing, Skyping, Zooming thing doesn't really do it for me. And that's another reason I just stopped doing it for a while. It's not as much fun to do it that way. And it didn't make any difference to Tucker, because Tucker had spectacular ratings, and he all through. I came back for a few weeks before I went overseas for the summer, and while I was overseas for the summer, They got in touch and said they didn't care where I was. They wanted to put a camera on the end of my nose, and we'd do it from there. And I didn't really want to do that because I needed a break. I was actually seriously depressed. But to go to your point, how do you reconcile the ratings phenomenon with the Harris-Biden ticket being 16 points up? And just to go back to what I was saying, if this is a base election, you can see that Tucker's base is energized and enthused. He's basically doubled the audience for that slot from what it was a couple of years ago. He's opened up a spectacular 500,000 gap between him and his nearest competitor. All those shows are doing, with one or two exceptions on Fox, I won't embarrass them by mentioning them. I would have thought, if this is a base election, as I said, what matters is how enthused your base is. There's 6 million people watching Tucker, which doesn't sound like a lot in a nation of 300 million, but by comparison, nobody is watching Rachel Maddow, who is the star at the MSNBC end of things. There's no equivalent enthusiasm. There was a point a couple of years ago, I think we'd be going to the summer of 2017 now, 3 years ago, when Rachel Maddow was actually beating Sean Hannity some nights, and there was clearly a big anti-Trump base, super enthused, for a while with Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell. Those numbers have never come back. There's no surge. There's no equivalent surge on MSNBC and CNN. That tells you something, that if this is a base election, then that's not looking good for the Joe Biden side. I tell you something else. If I'm wrong on this, and these polls are right, and we all go down the toilet on November 3rd, this should occasion a serious rethink on the narrow, stunted perspective of the American right, which I've talked about before. There are going to be people who matter after November the 3rd because they talked about things that matter, like my friend Tucker. Well, I'll set that to one side. Even if I didn't go on his show, I would watch his show because what he has to say is important and relevant. And that is not true of the narrow, stunted tunnel perspective on what it means to be a conservative in 2020, of many other of the grifters of Conservative Inc. And on November the 3rd, if it all goes down, if it's all slides off the cliff, once the dust has settled, there will be a few people who still matter, like Tucker, but a lot of the other people should never get a hearing again. And I mean that seriously. I want to win on November the 3rd, but if we're all off the cliff, there's a lot of things I ain't going to be wasting my time with after November the 3rd, and you should too. John Wilson says, this is like a change of topic. Mark, I love the fact that you use your own theme song instead of some piece of rock bilge. How long did it take you and Kevin Amos to write Nine Lives? Well, Nine Lives was originally written for my Cat album. I always do that thing where you've got your list of songs and you put them in a certain order and then you start recording them. And this actually came quite late in the process. And I thought we needed a big song to sum it all up. And of course, cats have nine lives, which is a kind of profound thought. And I thought perhaps there's a song about a cat having nine lives, and there wasn't. And I've had this before, like the Running on Eggnog song on the Christmas album, where I thought there must be a song about eggnog. And you listen through, and there were a few songs about eggnog. There was some like thrash metal thing about a guy wanting to commit suicide while drinking eggnog. And that didn't quite do it for me. That wasn't quite the eggnog song I was looking for. So at a certain point, it becomes easier to write it yourself. And it doesn't take a long time You know, it's the Whistler when he was in that court case over somebody sued him for overcharging for a painting. And they said, well, how long did it take you to paint this picture, Mr. Whistler? And he said, 2 hours and a lifetime of experience. And that's how long it takes you to write a song. Generally, I would say, I think I write one every 5 years or something. So I don't want to put myself in that thing. And there's a lot to be said for giving the old Lennon and McCartney answer when they were asked, how long does it take you when you sit down to write a song? And Paul McCartney said, well, there's always two things we do when we sit down to write a song. First, we sit down and then we write a song. And that's really the best way to leave it. And so me and Kevin, the first thing we did was we sat down and then we wrote a song. And it isn't quite like that. Kevin had this thing where we go very slow. He had these, like, because it's nine live, so he had these like ninths. When we get to the slow bit of the original track. And that's like a beautiful detail. I mean, it's like an in joke that only a serious musician would get, that in the colla voce bit, there's all these beautiful ninths underneath the vocal. And that stuff is sort of separate from the process. That's when you're just putting a button on it. But the reason we use it for the theme of the show is because originally I'd had an idea about sort of using an arrangement of Ain't You Coming Back to Old New Hampshire Molly, which is not a terribly good song from 115 years ago, that we were wasting a lot of time trying to make that number sound more interesting than it is. And it eventually just, oh, to hell with that. Why don't we just use Nine Lives? That's great. And so we did. And we use it in various different ways. And it became the sort of template, even for the times when we break with format and we don't use Nine Lives, like on our Christmas show. We basically use Marshmallow World sounding like Nine Lives sideways, so it's a great thing like that. And I hope that answer satisfies you, John. But if not, use the Paul McCartney one. First we sit down, then we write a song. Michael Sitnick writes, you regularly explain the need for conservatives, religious and traditionally minded people, to engage in shaping the culture of society, or at least to contribute to a competing subculture in order to achieve better results in both society at large and political policy. I agree, but as a group, we are not very good at going head-to-head with Disney, Universal Music Group, or the AP. Our Christian movies are earnest, but will never have the same production values and generally suffer from stilted and formulaic writing. Like the Jews in previous generations, we are being chased out of or locked out of entire segments of media, government, commercial and fine arts, academia, and even science and business. Credentialing is impossible, or at least arduous to navigate, for anyone coming up now, and we have a generation of conservative instructors being denied tenure. Most of my friends who have conservative values and liberal arts degrees wind up working in IT, where we provide for our families by helping to construct Sinistar, a malevolent video game leviathan who sucks up and devours everything in its path. In any event, playing the culture game on the enemy's terms seems like a chump's game. In your view, what does a cultural counter-revolution look like, and where do we start other than our contributions to the Mark Steyn Club? I agree with you on a lot of that, Michael. I'm not a big fan of things like Christian rock music, for example, where you have the same kind of wild, abandoned, sexual jungle rhythms, but with insipid anodyne lyrics over them. I don't see the point of that. And actually, I don't see the point in thinking about conservative culture in those terms. But again, it comes back to, you know, the narrowness of how we think about conservatism. And I have that. Every time I go on Rush, I have this. and I make a reference to, you know, Hello Dolly or something, and people say you shouldn't be talking about Broadway. Broadway's not conservative. Okay, Broadway's not conservative. Oh, and you shouldn't be talking about rock music. You know, rock music's not conservative. Okay, so we'll seed Broadway and we'll seed rock music and we'll seed novels and we'll seed motion pictures. And eventually you seed everything to the left and you're left with country music and NASCAR. And then those guys screw you over anyway. And more to the point, the country music and the NASCAR and the Chick-fil-A, oh, that's real manly, that's conservative country music. I like to eat Chick-fil-A while listening to country music on my way to NASCAR. And then NASCAR has the world's most stupid hate crime hoax with that guy's fake noose hanging in the garage of that he keeps his car in. And in fact, it's a garage door pull. So NASCAR treating... No, the New York City Ballet has never treated conservatives as insultingly as NASCAR did with that. The New York City Ballet has never treated conservatives as insultingly as the Chick-fil-A guys did when they decided that they were going for, they would now give, no longer oppose gay marriage, and they would cease giving money to charities unless those charities met the approval of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a shakedown racket of sex predators who keep all their money in British colony tax havens in the Caribbean. So they stopped giving money to the Salvation Army, which is one of the most genuinely good-hearted institutions on this continent. So, as I say, the New York City Ballet has never screwed you over the way that guy at Chick-fil-A did. It's not enough. It's not enough. And what happens when you wonder why, you know, Christian movies, as you put it, are so bad? It's because eventually you've been excluded from these fields for so long, for one, two, three generations, that no quote-unquote conservative knows actually how to make these things. And I completely agree with you on that. I have no interest in... all I would say about Christian... The only thing you can say for them is making your own Christian movie is better than this thing, absolutely contemptible thing they were doing for a while, where they would take the movie Titanic, but they would edit out Kate Winslet's breasts. For a start, Kate Winslet's breasts are two of the only three reasons to go and see Titanic. Those two breasts and the iceberg. That's it. The rest of the film is garbage. But the idea that they thought they could clean up another man's work. You know, the idea is Titanic is James Cameron. If you don't like James Cameron, be your own James Cameron. But don't bowdlerize James Cameron by removing Kate Winslet's breasts from Titanic. Because that's just intellectual property theft. You've got to make your own. You've got to make your own. And the only way, and again, I hope we don't, but we may have cause to reflect on this in a few weeks' time. I often say, you know, conservative donors gave $1 billion to Mitt Romney in 2012, and he tossed it into the Potomac. They would have been better off using that $1 billion to buy a movie studio. You've got to be able to make product and you've got to be able to distribute that product. And the right has no, unless you follow the model that Mel Gibson did, and he's Mel Gibson and you're not, with The Passion of the Christ, where you find alternative models, you're not going to be able to do that. But don't throw money. You know, don't give Mitt Romney $1 billion to piss into the Potomac and watch it float out to sea. You need systems. And I hear occasionally about systems, people who are starting a fiction imprint for new novels friendly to the right. And somehow they all just sort of dawdle around and nothing comes of it. In the event that there's a huge loss on November the 3rd, they're going to actually put us in the situation that Milan Kundera was in when he wrote his great novel, The Joke, about post-war, newly communist Czechoslovakia. So you won't actually be able to get elected because Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia will be states. And the judges won't matter because they're going to pack the Supreme Court. So there'll be 37 judges on the Supreme Court. So the fact that you managed to get five conservatives on there isn't going to matter because there's going to be 32 hack liberals there. And it's going to be important. It's going to be important to recognize that that narrow, reductive view of conservatism has gone. And actually, using the limited resources you have left, you have to sometimes, when Twitter clamped down on you, Twitter is getting more aggressive in the run-up to the election. They just said they were going to work harder today to label tweets as misinformation so they wouldn't be able to go viral. Okay, and who's on the panel that decides that? Twitter and Facebook and all that are going to be clampy, 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 clampy down. When I got into trouble in Canada, the penalty would be that I'd be forbidden from writing on anything on that subject ever again. Lifetime ban. So if you're found to be Islamophobic, by the Human Rights Commission, it's the equivalent of a lifetime ban on ever writing about Islam ever again. And I had these joke conversations with Ken White, the publisher and editor at Maclean's, what we were going to do then. We talked about things a little, you know, that we'd introduce some space cadet type guy who would be up there battling away on planet Islam up against the rare jihadi aliens somewhere in a distant galaxy thousands of years. We were going to actually introduce that because you'd have to write about things at one remove. You'd have to address things at one remove and leave people to pick up the logic. And that's what it's going to be. And that's what it's going to be. Because they're determined that what happened in 2016, it's not just they want to get Trump out, they want to ensure that Trump never happens again. And so we need to be on all the fields, on all the turf, this stupid, useless, narrow, reductive conservative ink has abandoned over half a century. Donna Freeman says, a while ago you suggested that the Durham criminal investigation would go nowhere. How did you know? I'd like to be able to tell you, Donna, that I was on the take and I had an inside line into the Department of Justice. But you don't need that. I mean, again, that's something we should quit on November the 3rd. All those rubes listening to shows going on about what did Andy McCabe know and when did he know it? Nobody out there in America has heard of these people, and the only penalty they're going to get for attempting a coup is they're going to get a big contributor deal at CNN and a fantastic book contract. And that was perfectly obvious two, three years ago. Henry Eversole, we're coming up to the end of the show, but I want to take a couple of quickie extra questions. Henry Eversole says, doubtless all your readers agree that the willingness of citizens to abandon civil liberties long fought for is disheartening to say the least, but the pandemic has also inflicted a coup de grace on what's left of free markets. No longer, it seems, does monetary policy restrain fiscal policy. They are in lockstep. Of course, the Fed has interfered in treasury markets for years. Now they are purchasing junk bonds and junk ETFs. How long before they emulate their Japanese brethren and print currency to purchase common stocks? Where will this road lead, in your view? Says Henry. Just to attend to that last question, I believe China is now the dominant power on the planet. China gets its way in the world. America doesn't. and the institutions that American taxpayers fund, like the UN agencies, like the World Health Organization, America pays for them, but they do China's bidding. So where this road ultimately leads is the next phase. China's in a hurry. That's why it picked a shooting war with India in May. That's why it's doing overflights over Taiwan. It's in a hurry. Chairman Xi wants the formal acknowledgement of global dominance to happen on his watch. And destroying the US dollar as the global currency is high up on his to-do list. As you say, the pandemic has liberated the Fed from its last remaining restraints, so that they're now purchasing junk bonds, which has had the effect of making an even bigger gulf between Wall Street and Main Street, to the point where Wall Street bears no relation to what's happening on Main Street. Increasingly bears less relationship to reality. And it doesn't really function as an expression of the American market or the American economy anymore. And the junk bonds, if I've got my timeline right on this, it was literally a week or two into this thing. So in other words, sort of the third or fourth week in March, that the Fed began buying up the junk bonds. And at that point, they said that they basically took the view that the Fed was going to protect the market, even as hairdressers couldn't open their hair salons and waitresses couldn't work in diners. Junk bond traders were protected. Junk bonds ought to be a high-risk activity. But the fact is that the Fed's actions, which again is 6 months ago now, actually made it a safer activity to be in than cutting hair for a living or serving up a corned beef on rye for a living. So it actually widened the gulf between Wall Street and Main Street. And it's one of the many disturbing aspects of this. I don't know why Jay Powell did that. Don't know why at all, except that I think they thought the market was immediately vulnerable to Chinese machinations in a way that the diners and the hair salons weren't. But where this road leads ultimately, I think, and very soon, is I do believe the Chinese want to end the reign of the US dollar. And I often talk about what the Americans did to the British at the time of the Suez Crisis, what they did to sterling, and I would be very wary. The British didn't see that coming, and I doubt anybody in Washington will see it coming when the Chinese move on that. That's a bit of a depressing thought to end on. Dan says, we can't end on that. Dan says, if Donald J. Trump had asked you to run his campaign, would you have accepted? I don't think you have any choice in things like that, actually. I so regret the fact that so much of the campaign money was wasted, and this guy, Dan Parscale, who's now institutionalized, blew through it all, came out of it with a $2.4 million waterfront home for himself, came out with it with a Ferrari for himself, and did nothing for Donald John Trump's chances of re-election. I don't really buy into the experts, and if I had been asked to run the campaign, I would have made the point I made earlier. The Trump base is an alliance between Trump fans and Trumpism fans. And Trumpism, you know, the reason he won in 2016, I said it in the very first piece I wrote about it in early July 2015. Karl Rove had been suggesting that people could talk about immigration in a more inclusive way. And I pointed out to Karl that, in fact, they weren't. They weren't doing that. They were talking about immigration from the point of view of the immigrants. and not from the point of view of the people who are already here. And I pointed out that Lindsey Graham, you know, wanted boots on the ground on every country on the face of the earth. He was the only one who raised a serious substantive issue when he came down that escalator. And the fact that the escalator is garish and Trump Tower is garish and there's gold dripping everywhere and Trump is Trump and he has videos of him talking about grabbing persons by their private parts and all the rest of it, none of it mattered because he was talking about Trumpism. And right now, there's a little too much Trump and there's not quite enough Trumpism. And he can change that. It's 3.5 weeks to go. That would be about 60% of a Canadian or UK election. So there's plenty of time to change that. If you think in Canadian or Australian or continental terms. But we are running out of time in American terms. And I don't want to go into the abyss. So make sure you vote and make sure that you find one other person and you ensure that they vote too. This has been Mark Stein. I've been so tied up with TV and radio. I did Rush on Tuesday, so I thought I'd postpone our Mark Stein show schedule for that day to Thursday. And then Thursday, I got a call that Rush had been clobbered by the chemo and would I do Thursday show, so it's got a bit. But we will have a show for you tomorrow because it is Columbus Day and it's Canadian Thanksgiving. And Canadian Thanksgiving will be here next year, but if Biden wins, this is going to be basically the last Columbus Day. So we will have a show for you tomorrow and all our other features. And that's the thing now. It's important. It's a base election. It's a base. It's Biden's base versus Trump's base. So if you don't want to go over the cliff, make sure you at least try and ensure that one other person in your circle actually commits himself and gets to the poll. Drive your Auntie Mabel to the poll. That's what it's going to be. It's a base election and it's turnout. We will see you, I think, just before the big election day, and we will check out how things look then. But this has been our Clubland Q&A. I thank you for all your interesting questions. We'll pick some of the ones I didn't get to for the days ahead, and we will see you right back here for another Q&A just before the big day on November 3rd.